Masha. That was beautiful. Masha, our choir is recruiting, so I just wanted to add that to you. So please consider that. Will you join me now in a moment of prayer? Loving Spirit of wisdom and light, lover of our souls, healer of our scars, we give thanks for the gift of gathering together in community. Grant us an awareness of your presence among us, moving in us, around us, and through us. In your many holy names we pray. Amen. So, in the summertime, people often go to the beach or to the mountains or sometimes to both. And so, with the end of August in sight from where we stand, and as the traditional days of summer begin to draw to a close, so our summer vacation to the mountains of the Bible concludes this Sunday. Now, there are a lot more mountains in the Bible than there are beaches. And while my original intent was to focus on some of the lesser-known mountains, that didn't quite work out. I got called to and by the bigger and more well-known mountains. So just don't be surprised someday if we visit the mountains again. I've had great fun wandering around from peak to peak. Such pointedly themed sermon series often have a way of encouraging us to focus on old things, to breathe new life into old things in new and exciting ways. One thing I did hold true to this summer was to make use of some new authors for our second reading. I was very intentional about expanding my literary view in a theological vein, and I felt very challenged by that, in a good way. And while it worked me very hard, I think it's given me a wonderful mountaintop perspective of a wider literary and theological landscape. Now, of course, it could be argued that in my selection of a second reading this Sunday, I have failed in my aim of going outside of my go-to writers. Now, however, in my defense, I could find nothing else that fit this week. And so I seemed led to this conclusion more by a matter of exclusion than by any matter of intentional selection. Plus, given that my ordination anniversary is tomorrow, my service has been much in my thoughts this week. And finally, I think that I've only used this particular author, me, for a second reading only once in over 20 years of preaching. So please forgive me. Now, as I mentioned last week, mountains are places of clarity and places of perspective, places where we are challenged and we are strengthened, places of wonder and amazement where we face danger and uncertainty, and where we have the opportunity to be strengthened, to grow in both wisdom and in skill. But what a mountain offers to us does not come easily. We must work our way up in order to receive the gifts that they provide. And the sense of knowing where we are and where we are going, and in climbing that incline and working our way toward that clarity, we often acquire just what we need for our journey ahead. Now, in the Bible, God often calls people to mountains and often calls to people from mountains, speaks from mountains. And so it's very fitting that this week we visit the mount, the place where Jesus gave his biggie, the sermon on the mount. Now, it is the essence of the moral teachings of Jesus, and it begins with chapter 5 in Matthew. Matthew, a book of 28 chapters. So Jesus had only just begun. And what a beginning! And we begin with the first line in chapter 5. When Jesus saw the crowds, he went up the mountain. And concludes with the first line of chapter 8. When Jesus came down from the mountain, large crowds followed him. And he got on with it. So between when he went up the mountain with pretty much just his disciples, which when we hear that, we may automatically think the 12 beards. But in reality, it is much more likely that it was a mixed group of individuals, men, women, children, a group of his followers at that time whose number is not actually known. But think close followers. So between when he went up the mountain and came down the mountain, we have three solid chapters of teachings. Teachings presented not as one of the scribes in teachy-preachy language, but rather plain-spoken and relevant, giving life to life's lessons. Offered as one having authority, experience, and great familiarity with the subject matter of divine inspiration and human behavior. Jesus spoke and taught in parable, myth, and metaphor. For example, you have heard me speak on the reference to salt here. You have all heard me say that when Jesus said, "You are the salt of the earth," the word used for earth means earth, but it also means earthen oven, the type of oven that most families used at that time to cook their daily bread. And they used the fuel that was the most plentiful, a mixture of earth, dung, and some chaff, all made burnable with the catalyst of salt. Salt plates at the base of the oven. Now, how does salt really lose its saltiness? The plates will eventually lose their catalytic capability, and they are no longer good for that purpose. Some in the Middle East still use this kind of oven and this fuel to this day. So Jesus is saying, here is your purpose. Be a catalyst. Help to make it happen. Illuminate, provide warmth, and provide nourishment. Be a catalyst to that. I mean, that teaching itself is brilliant. That is speaking to the people of that day in everyday terms that they would immediately understand. Not like us who wander around and look at the salt on the table and wonder what we're talking about. This is terms that they would understand in that day, terms to explain deeply spiritual concepts. These people likely never lit an earthen oven again without thinking about their purpose. Now that's beautiful. Don't lose your purpose. Stay salty, my friends. So let's follow Jesus up the mount and sit there. Between chapters 5 and chapter 8, we have the Beatitudes. And we have, say what you mean. Quote, swear not by heaven or earth, but let your yes mean yes and your no mean no. And we have, you have heard it said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Equal retribution for wrongs done to you? But does that make it right? No. Turn the other cheek. Go the extra mile. And love your enemy. And don't sound a trumpet before you when you do charitable things. In other words, don't toot your own horn when you give, because eventually you will just give so that you can toot your own horn. And that's not what giving is about. You see, Jesus is getting into some deep feelings here. He is teaching spiritual principles from the top down, actions that at once seem counterintuitive, and yet at the same time both move and resonate deeply within the human soul. We also have how to pray, the prayer that Jesus taught us, which is a community prayer. It is not a selfish, my creator, my bread. No, it is our creator. It is our daily bread. It is a community prayer. Forgive others their shortcomings just as God forgives yours. Oh, and we also have, when you are fasting, don't look miserable. Don't go around with a sad, hungry face. So as to garner pity and draw attention to yourself, when you fast, wash your face. Anoint your head with oil so that only God knows that you are fasting. And we have, you cannot serve two masters, God and money. Pick one. Choose wisely. And we have, don't worry. Worry will not change one single thing. I saw a movie last night, and the man should have been concerned all the way through the movie, but he wasn't. And the other man kept asking him, you don't look worried. And he said, would it help? And that's the truth. Would it help? Don't live in worry for tomorrow. Live now in this moment, for that is the cradle of life, and it's where life happens. And we have judge not, and you will not be judged. And we also have don't be a hypocrite, just don't. We also have ask, and you shall receive, seek, and you shall find, knock, and it shall be opened unto you. Wow. Ask and you shall receive. Now, in order to ask, you must know what you want. You can't have an idle want. You have to know what you want. And in asking, you must articulate what you want. You must begin to flesh it out and form it in your thoughts. When you find the words to know exactly what you want, then it ceases to be some sort of vague longing inside of you. It becomes something that you know dearly and clearly. So clearly that you can actually ask for it. You can then seek it. And if you know what you are looking for, you will find it. I promise you. Although it may indeed take some looking. Jesus is teaching how to overcome many of life's challenges and obstacles. And he is doing so on a mountain, which is metaphorical for life's challenges and obstacles. Also, as Jesus saw the crowds, he moved up the mountain. As he is teaching, so he is also moving away from the crowds. Moving away from the way of the crowds. Moving in a direction opposite of the ethos of that time. Heck, even our time. Moving away from the behavior of the majority, away from what was popular thought. His very body and his body movement was teaching us this. It's brilliant. It's genius. And it is still alive. Over 2,000 years away, even half a world culture and several language translations later, the words do live, and they are alive today. Any one of these lessons is not only enough for a sermon series, but enough to guide the journey of an entire lifetime. Now, the Beatitudes. Jesus relating what we have commonly come to call the Beatitudes, and doing so on the mountain, is often contrasted with Moses and the Ten Commandments, which was on the mountain that we visited last week. Especially since Jesus later almost invites such a comparison by saying, you have heard the ancients say, you shall not murder. But I say, whosoever is angry at another without cause is in danger of judgment. Whosoever says raka to another. Now that's an insulting word. It was an epithet. Its root word meaning to spit. Whosoever says raka to another is in danger of judgment. Jesus is saying not only just do not murder, but don't even start down that path of aggression. Don't even start down that road of rage. Jesus is always pushing at the margins, the edges of things. Don't commit adultery. But hey, even with a thought, then you have done so in your heart. So just don't even go there in your head. Jesus didn't say, be good only to those who can do something for you. And when he said, visit the prisoners, he didn't say, now just visit only the innocent prisoners. No, he said, visit the prisoner. Why did he even talk about visiting prisons at all? Sometimes that amazes me. Clearly, this is the voice of one who has had some experience with the criminal justice system. And in visiting prisons, you may visit prisoners who were found guilty of things that you cannot even imagine. Do the hard stuff. Be the presence of Christ to those in hard places. The Beatitudes surfaced in the lectionary earlier this year, and I have known preachers to devote an entire Sunday to each single Beatitude. They are beautiful teachings. Beatitude comes from the Latin beatus, which means blessed or happy, happiness. It also means honor and fortunate. In fact, different Bible translations opt for different words. For example, happy are people who show mercy because they will receive mercy. Honored are people who have clean hearts because they will see God. Fortunate are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. But here's the thing, the real beauty. The meaning of the Beatitudes is not immediately apparent, at least not to me. Maybe I'm thick, but they have always puzzled me. This is not the simple honor your parents. No, this is more esoteric. It's more mysterious. It's mystical. It's heavy. It's hidden. It's inscrutable. We are drawn into what Jesus is talking about. He pulls us up from the beginning in his journey up the mount. And it just goes on from there, higher and higher. Now, for me, the Beatitudes invite another way of experiencing the world. Another way of examining the work. The work of what Judaism calls tikkun olam, which is Hebrew meaning repairing the world, or construction for eternity, or healing the world. I mean this bit about fortunate are those who mourn, they will be comforted. What does that even mean? Well, after life experience, what it means to me is that I have work to do. It is a promise of the divine that I must make good on. Why? Because it is mine to do this. If not me, then who? If not now, then when? I am called to work in partnership with Christ to fulfill that promise. For it is up to us to comfort those who mourn, to do the work of justice for those who hunger and thirst for it, to be an answer to someone else's prayer. It is important to make these things live, to make them come to life. In my work in doing so, there have been times that I have looked at the Beatitudes and thought of a face who fulfills each one for me. For example, fortunate are those who work for peace, for they shall be called the children of God. Who is that child of God for me? It is most often Bayard Rustin, the African-American gay Quaker man who was at the heart of Martin Luther King's nonviolent movement. The 30th anniversary of his death was just a few days ago, on August 24th. When Bayard first visited Martin's house, he found men everywhere with guns at the ready to defend and protect Martin Luther King. In fact, guns were so prevalent there that a reporter that Bayard Rustin was with that evening almost sat on a pistol. Bayard was mortified. Now, in what I think is one of his most powerful statements, he said, quote, "When I say I love James Eastland was an ugly, hateful, hurtful, sick politician at that time. When I say I love James Eastland, it sounds preposterous. A man who brutalizes people. But you love him or you wouldn't be here. You're going to Mississippi to create social change. And you love James Eastland in your desire to create conditions which will redeem his children. Loving your enemy is manifest in putting your arms not around the man, but around the social situation, taking power from those who misuse it, at which point they can become human too. They can become human too. Bayard Rustin, peacemaker, child of God. Who are other children of God for you? Who is the face of the merciful for you? Who are those clean in heart? Think and name them. Put names and faces to those who are the Beatitudes for you, for our history and for this nation. Who are those making good on the divine promises? After you have put faces in those places, can you imagine your face among those faces? Your face among those faces. What are you doing to heal this world? This weary world in deep need of healing. It doesn't take much. A smile, a kind word, a bit of gentleness, a bit of putting yourself in the other person's shoes. And oftentimes we find that in working to heal the world, we also heal ourselves. We are blessed by being a blessing to others, by being a vessel through which the blessing may pass through us. And in doing so, we receive our own blessing. Or you can bring the Beatitudes to life by forming and creating your own Beatitudes. Blessed are the white gays and lesbians of privilege, for they shall know just a small taste of the bitter flavor of injustice, so that they may use their privilege in the struggle of justice for others who have none. Blessed are those who are trans and gender fluid, for they shall be given a rare glimpse of how the world is parted, separated, divided into this or that, and that by their own liberation from an unfair and burdensome sexist system, that they may learn to struggle for the freedom of all souls imprisoned by oppressive gender roles. The mountain from which Jesus taught is here, right now. Now, an ordination is a big deal. You could say that it is a service of marriage to an occupation, a vocation, a calling, to a way of life. But that doesn't always mean that you can make a living from that way of life. Can I get an amen from preachers here? Now, my mentor told me that the ordination service is the only service outside of my funeral where it is indeed all about me. Yes. So I created my ordination very carefully, filled with metaphor and symbolism of the things that really mattered to me. The altar was covered with things that were important to me in my life. I even had a little statue of Betty Boop up on the altar. Symbolic of the fact that we bring all of who we are to the service of God, to the altar of God in offering. My robe and my stole were given to me along my journey up the aisle, not by ministers or elders or bishops, but by friends. Friends who had given me the honor of comforting them as they mourned. Friends who showed me mercy when God knew I needed it. Friends who taught me the meaning of being poor in spirit, the poverty of spirit that teaches the awesome love and grace of God like no preacher ever can. These were my friends who put my robe on me, who put my stole on me, because that's where those things come from. My vows, the ordination vows of most are quite long and wordy. Now, I don't say that out of judgment, but at every ordination I have sat through, the vows always made me think, wow, that's a lot to remember. How can anyone ever hope to keep up with all of that? fidelity to this belief and that, honoring the polity of the denomination. I kept mine simple, and my vows were something that I already aimed to keep all my life, and I share them with you today in the same spirit of the Beatitudes. Simple, but not really. No matter the mountain we move up, you and God know what it is. No matter the mountain we move up, as we journey back down the mountain this morning, I would encourage you, nay, I would challenge you to think about your vows. Think about your promises. What are your promises? What are the promises that you have already kept? What are your aspirations? What are you doing to heal this broken world? Heal the wounds. Keep steady and mend the broken hearts when a world is falling apart. We have work to do, and we have only just begun. Let's get on with it.